So welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. And for this conversation, I'm talking with Dr. Michael Murray. Hi, Dr. Murray.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
It's great to have you. I think this is going to be a really interesting topic for people. As we were discussing over email what to explore, at this point in recording, I'm not quite sure where this one's going to land in the agenda, but at this point in recording, having done most of the interviews, this just felt like an area no one's really touched on. And it feels like with the significant influx of products and kind of claims that are being made around CBD, this felt like an area that we should be exploring. And as I was going a bit more into your work around it, it's kind of a rabbit warren and a kind of fascination. So I'm really keen to get into it. Just to give people your background, Dr. Michael Murray is one of the world's leading authorities on natural medicine. He's published over 30 books featuring natural approaches to health. He is a graduate, former faculty member, and serves on the board of Regents of Bastyr University in Seattle, Washington. Dr. Murray is the chief science officer of NZ Medica. And as I've been talking with various people about this conference of speakers, I should also say you're one of the people that people consistently said you need to talk to Dr. Murray. So I'm very happy to have you as part of it. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
I'd love to just start a bit with all of this kind of talk and noise that's happening around cannabis products and CBD. It rather feels that we're getting a bit ahead of, it certainly feels to me like we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves in terms of some of the claims, some of the expectations. So maybe we could just start a bit with where are we in terms of the actual evidence base and the actual research that exists?
Well, I'm a little bit of an unpopular character talking about CBD because I highlight what the research shows, and there's very little research. And what research there is, the clinical research there is, it doesn't support many of the claims that are being made. The therapeutic efficacy of any natural product or drug is based upon delivering an effective dose, and we don't really know what an effective dose is of CBD. We do know that it's poorly absorbed and it's quickly metabolized and broken down to compounds that aren't very active. There are studies with CBD for a few different applications, but the results from those studies aren't all that impressive. Yes, it's been shown to be helpful in rare forms of epilepsy, but when you start really looking at the data, even in that application, the numbers needed to treat are really high, meaning that not that many people are really going to show much benefit from it. When you're looking at some of the data with CBD, clinical data, they've looked at it for example, in insomnia, and they found, at lower dosages, it doesn't seem to be very effective. So the dosage that's probably effective is in the range of 300 to 450 milligrams per day. That's a far cry from the recommendations that many marketers are making for the product of 5, 10, 15, 25 milligram dosage. They talk about the entourage effect, but really when we're talking about cannabis and the entourage effect, we're talking about cannabis components that help THC work a bit better. As far as CBD goes, although not technically correct from a chemistry aspect, if you look at the molecule THC and if you break the cyclic ring, that's where you have CBD. And I make the comment to physicians that CBD is basically a broken THC molecule. And we're way ahead on the recommendations. Now, I do believe that there are other components in cannabis besides cannabinoids that have pharmacological activity. There are terpenes and flavonoids and other compounds that certainly are active. We know that they're active. But I'd like to remind people that the endocannabinoid system predates the cannabis plant. So we kind of, because it's named after the cannabis plant, we kind of think that the only way to influence that system is is with cannabis. And the truth of the matter is I think that a more comprehensive approach to gaining the benefits that many people are seeking with taking CBD can be achieved by working to tune up a person's endocannabinoid system through diet, through lifestyle, through proper supplementation with some herbal compounds and with some specialty nutritional compounds. I think that's a much more rational approach. The endocannabinoid system is not really a hero system. And what I mean by that is some systems, if we manipulate them, like the GABAergic system, there are many drugs that, you know, if you take a Valium, if you take a Halcyon, if you take a Xanax, you're basically pounding that GABAergic system and you're getting a really profound effect. With the endocannabinoid system, it's really a system that's set up to regulate balance, homeostasis. And so it kind of sets the stage for some hero ingredients, such as, you know, various nutritional compounds and herbal compounds or drugs. But in itself, that system is really not powerful enough sometimes to really produce a pharmacological effect or the type of medicinal response that we see through activation or enhancement of other chemical systems through the body.
It's fascinating going deeper into this system, because it feels like, as you've kind of touched on, that there's a kind of romanticism around this idea of kind of taking CBD or having something which has this kind of overarching effect. But actually this underlying system, it's something which exists in all animals except for insects, and that it's its own bodily system. And maybe to say a bit more about how this actual kind of system works and how it interfaces with other bodily systems as a way of having its impact.
Yeah, the endocannabinoid system, like many systems in our body, chemical systems, is kind of a key and lock system where we have receptors on cells throughout the body that are called endocannabinoid receptors, and there are two types. CB1, it has more psychoactive activity, and CB2, it doesn't have that psychoactive activity, but it has actions on the immune system, the gastrointestinal tract, on the nervous system in general. And so, you know, THC is a prime example of a CB1 receptor agonist, and CBD is more of a CB2 receptor agonist. But there are many compounds that activate these receptors to varying degrees. You know, THC is a bit of a special compound with that CB1 receptor. It really fits in there very powerfully and produces that effect. But there are other activators in nature of these receptors. And our body actually makes compounds that bind to these receptors. That word endo means within, and cannabinoid is named after these cannabis compounds. But we actually have compounds in our body that bind to those receptors. And these include, you know, these fatty acid derivatives. One of them is called anandamide. And this compound was originally referred to as the bliss molecule.
And that's quite a claim.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that we can manufacture ourselves. And in fact, when we are feeling blissful, we've got a lot of this compound being produced. There are other lipid mediators that are responsible for either binding to these receptors or modulating them. Another one is 2-AG. And then there's a PEA, which is short for palmitoyl ethanolamide. This compound is actually available as a dietary supplement. And I think it provides the real answers that many people are looking for from CBD. For example, one of the prime uses of CBD in the U.S., and I assume in the U.K. and other places, is in pain relief. But do you know how many studies there are with CBD as a pain reliever? None. Right. Yeah, there's not a single study, and it's likely not to have much of an analgesic or pain relieving action. Again, the therapeutic efficacy is based upon dose, and we just don't know what is an effective dose. And I believe it's much higher than what is commonly recommended. With PEA, we have over 17 double-blind placebo-controlled studies in pain, and positive results have been produced in low back pain, sciatic pain, osteoarthritis, fibromyalgia, peripheral neuropathies, kind of neurological pain related to stroke and multiple sclerosis, chronic pelvic and vaginal pain, and post-herpetic neuralgia. And in these studies, PEA shown remarkable effectiveness. One of the ways we measure the effectiveness of a drug in pain is called numbers needed to treat. And that means how many people do you have to treat to reduce the pain by at least 50%. If we look at the numbers needed to treat with PEA in low back pain, it's 1.5. So you have to treat 1.5 people to see a 50% reduction in pain. Now, ibuprofen, one of the more popular nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, at 400 milligrams a day, the numbers needed to treat is 2.8. Acetaminophen, Tylenol, how do you say it in the UK? Paracetamol? Yeah,
I'm not going to be able to help you on that one, Dr. Murray.
Oh, you just have the accent.
Exactly.
Where are you from, Alex?
I'm from the UK. No, I live in London. I'm from the UK.
Okay.
But you're stretching my my medical knowledge by answering.
Oh, the question. Okay. So anyway, these are popular drugs. For Tylenol, the number needed to treat is 5. So the point is that in these detailed double-blind placebo-controlled studies, PEA outperforms over-the-counter and some prescription drugs quite considerably. And I just don't think you're going to get better results with CBD than what has already been shown with PEA. And PEA has also been shown to be helpful in some of the other applications, namely with anxiety and depression. And when you look at its mechanisms of action in pain and inflammation and depression, again, I think it's the answer that people are trying to achieve by taking CBD. As I said, the clinical results with CBD that we have right now are not that impressive. There were some studies in anxiety, but those studies used really high doses, 450 to 600 milligrams per day, and they didn't show much of a benefit at those really high doses. So if you're not going to see the benefits at high doses, I don't think you're going to see the lower dosages being all that effective. And you know, we kind of focus on these using these hero compounds, whether it's CBD or PEA, but really to address the issues of an endocannabinoid system dysfunction or insufficiency, you really have to approach it from a very comprehensive standpoint. You've got to really focus on lifestyle, diet, and proper supplementation. And I think that's the future. The endocannabinoid system is going to be a major focus of not only drug research, but from a natural medicine perspective, we're going to be working on ways to enhance that endocannabinoid system. But we're not going to be using these hero ingredients. We're going to form a strong foundation of diet, nutrition, stress relief, sleep, exercise, and other factors that are really powerful influencers on this system. And what's interesting about this endocannabinoid system, remember, this is a system that its primary function is to promote homeostasis. And what does that mean? That means that every cell in our body strives to maintain a consistent internal environment so it can function properly. And when you have disruption in homeostasis, you have disruption in cellular function. Another word for that is disease. So the endocannabinoid system is an underlying factor in virtually every disease you can think of. And that's why people are jumping to the conclusion that CBD is the answer, and it may be part of the answer, but I think we can't lose sight on these other important aspects of influencing this important system, namely through diet, lifestyle, and proper supplementation.
I mean, one of the things that seems interesting is that people which are naturally drawn towards a natural health methodology and understand the importance of a multifaceted approach, it's kind of interesting how there's been pockets of practitioners who have suddenly kind of latched onto this kind of one kind of miracle thing. And actually, you kind of touched on it before, but when I was watching a presentation that you'd given on this, one of the things that was really interesting was actually looking at, for example, of cases of epilepsy. And if you were to follow the mainstream news here, certainly in the UK, there's been a number, I guess, maybe up to half a dozen or so cases over the last 12, 18 months of mothers of children with epilepsy who have found that by giving them, I think it's a psychoactive form of CBD, have had a dramatic reduction in seizures. I mean, to the point of like going from seizures multiple times a day to not having them, to then going abroad, buying them, and then getting stopped by customs and having thousands of pounds of CBD taken away from them. And then it becomes this big news story that, you know, the government is taking away the only drug that's supporting this child with epilepsy. That it starts to feel like, oh my God, well, this must be this kind of miracle answer. And as I was looking at your presentation, part of what was interesting was that actually that the research data, as you touched on, was something like 177 people or something that you would have to see to have that significant effect in terms of reduction. So again, it's that the real world data being very different to the perception and the news stories around it.
Yeah. So in the case of epilepsy, when we are talking about numbers needed to treat, you have to see a 50% reduction in seizures. So the number needed to treat for one person to achieve a 50% reduction in seizures isn't too bad. It's 8. Okay. But these are people that aren't getting relief from conventional medicine, and so reducing their seizure number and severity by 50% is huge. So you might have to treat 8 people, but it's worth it. But for someone to achieve complete seizure freedom from CBD alone, it's really high. It's 171. So that it's just not a very effective solo medicine. Now that's with CBD alone. The Sativex is a mixture of THC and CBD, and I think the numbers needed to treat are better. I think in the future we're going to recognize that the importance of THC to the overall action of cannabis, but we will be able to maybe reduce the amount of THC so it doesn't have all those psychoactive effects. The chemistry of cannabis is quite interesting. It has over 62 unique compounds that aren't found in any other plant. And these compounds, many times when the plant is smoked, for example, or vaped, these are converted into many more compounds. Over 2,000 different compounds are created when cannabis is heated. And some of these compounds definitely contribute to its overall pharmacology. So it may, everyone's kind of moving to edibles in different forms, but it may turn out that there's some advantages to some people with CBD, for example, if it's vaped versus, taking it in a pill. And the pharmacokinetics, the way the body handles CBD, is much different when it's inhaled versus when it's ingested orally. There may be some value there. And I know that a lot of people are using CBD in these various preparations topically. Again, there may be some differences in the way the CBD is utilized when it's applied topically, where you're actually getting better results, like for arthritis, if you're rubbing it on the area that's affected versus trying to take it orally. There's so much that we don't know, but we do have some basic science information on cannabis and CBD. I think that it points to possibly delivering CBD via different routes, such as vaping or topically. And it also may be that some of these other compounds are responsible for the kind of the medicinal effects of that are being attributed to CBD, basically these terpenoids and flavonoids. One of my favorite examples to illustrate that is one of my favorite natural products is deglycerinated licorice. This is a special licorice extract where they remove glycerotinic acid. Glycerotinic acid is a healthful compound from licorice, but some people can have an elevation in blood pressure. Glycerotinic acid was the first compound, drug or natural compound, shown in a double-blind placebo-controlled study to be helpful in peptic ulcer disease. What's interesting about that is they started utilizing it as an ulcer medication, but then some people started having reactions to having high blood pressure. And when they were looking at developing a placebo once in one of the studies, they used the deglycerinated licorice. That's where they took the glycerotinic acid out of the licorice and gave the placebo group this DGL, and they found it worked better than the glycerotinic acid. So here's my point. What medicine thought was the active ingredient, when they removed it, that crude plant extract was actually more effective than what they thought was the active constituent. Now, ideally, you know, probably using the whole plant with both the glycerotinic acid and the other components might be the best approach. And I think that's what we're going to find out with cannabis. I think that what will likely be discovered is that these terpenoids, flavonoids, other compounds are very important to the overall medicinal effect of cannabis, and that includes THC and CBD. Cannabis is going to be around. It's going to be a huge business. And we're going to have, with science, greater understanding of how we can utilize the plant, what forms are best, what preparations are best. Do we need THC? Can we get the same benefit without it? How important is CBD? Do we need these other compounds? All of these things are going to be answered. But right now, I think there's a bit of a snake oil aspect to it, with the focus so much on CBD.
And I think we need those people which are off, you know, trying to make their fortune with CBD to actually pump some of that money back to research as well, right? Because it seems like it's that kind of classic thing that something gets that becomes the fad, and then you get the inflated claims, and then there's the kind of pocketing of the money off the back of the inflated claims. And if actually some of that money went back to research, you might actually build some substance behind, or you might build more substance, let's say, behind the movements.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the finals number were for 2018, but it's easily to see that the CBD market in the U.S. alone is over $1 billion a year. And with all that money, there's no funding of any significant research right now.
Just to change tack slightly and to come back to this endocannabinoid system piece, how about endocannabinoid deficiency syndrome? It, as I was kind of looking at your work, that struck me as something that could also be a factor in fatigue and even chronic fatigue syndrome. So maybe you touch on that a bit.
Yeah, no question about it. It's a real entity. This was the endocannabinoid deficiency syndrome is thought to be an underlying contributing factor in chronic fatigue syndrome, which is very central to probably what a lot of the viewers are interested in: fatigue, fibromyalgia, migraines, IBS, and seizure disorders. It's a condition where the endocannabinoid system is compromised due to either, you know, kind of poor nutrition, or more often prolonged exposure to psychological, physical, or emotional stress. Stress is very detrimental to the endocannabinoid system. So a lot of the things that are helpful for dealing with stress are really important in building up our endocannabinoid system. Anyone that's dealing with these conditions that I just mentioned, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, migraines, IBS, seizure disorders, they are going to benefit probably more than any other groups with focusing on improving that endocannabinoid system.
Are there any particular ways that you find that are helpful to get clues that someone may have a deficiency that's going on here? Like, what is it primarily clinical picture, or are there a particular kind of test beyond that?
You know, there's really no tests right now. It's basically just, looking at where the endocannabinoid system plays a significant role. And in matching that with what people are experiencing, we know that these endocannabinoid receptors are concentrated in certain tissues. So CB2 receptors are very much concentrated in the immune system, gastrointestinal tract, and peripheral and central nervous system. So we know that the endocannabinoid system is a central control system in those tissues. And again, when you have loss of homeostasis, you have disease. And the cells are trying their best, and sometimes they're somewhat functional, but there's a low level of function. And that's really what you're looking at with something like chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia. The cells just aren't getting fully recharged. They're not able to protect themselves or get rid of toxins or respond to hormones and controlling factors like they should. So, we should probably give some specifics of how to support the endocannabinoid system. Fats are really important, and it's no different than when we're talking about what fats do we need to eat to support our brain, what fats do we need to eat to support our cardiovascular system, what fats do we need to consume to reduce our risk of having cancer. Basically, the monounsaturated fats that we get from nuts, seeds, olive oil, avocado, these are really important. So too are the long chain omega-3 fatty acids that we get from fish and fish oil supplements. Although omega-6 oils are important to the endocannabinoid system, most people living today are getting enough of those omega-6, so we don't really need to be that concerned with the omega-6 unless somebody's really on a low-fat diet. Stress reduction and regular exercise is a critical contributor to having a healthy endocannabinoid system. Learning to breathe with that diaphragm, learning to put yourself in that relaxed state, becoming mindful, working on that mind-body connection, that seems to reinforce the formation of these compounds that our body produces and our brain produces that bind to those endocannabinoid receptors. Hot and cold therapy seems to be an important contributor to maintaining the tone of that endocannabinoid system. So classic hydrotherapy, saunas, steam, cold water baths, a simple one is just when you're done with your shower in the morning, the hot shower that we all love. If you just switch it on to immediately to cold water for a few seconds, that's a good way to tone up that endocannabinoid system.
It always sounds so easy. It's always so unappealing.
Yeah, it does. I got my hair cut the other day, and they I don't know why, when they wash your hair, they like to do a cool rinse at the end. And it's probably really good for your hair and hair shaft, and good for your endocannabinoid system, but I always tell them, I don't need the cauldrons. But, you know, I do think that, you know, getting that shot of cold is good. And I do that on occasion, not as much as I probably should. But, you know, I've got my endocannabinoid system's working pretty good. Anything that's going to support your adrenal glands is going to support your endocannabinoid system. So there are a lot of herbs that have historically been used to support the adrenal glands. And it's interesting, Alex, we call these herbs adaptogens, you know, things like Siberian ginseng, Panax ginseng, rhodiola, ashwagandha. And one of the interesting things about these adaptogens is that they have an ability to basically increase our overall sense of well-being, and they tend to help our body and brain and emotions deal with stress better. These are clues that these herbs are working on the endocannabinoid system. So dietary supplements and herbs that work to support the adrenal glands work to support the endocannabinoid system. And the last area that I love to talk about for supporting the endocannabinoid system is the use of herbs and spices. Herbs and spices are powerful influencers on the endocannabinoid system. I tell people to spice it up, to use herbs liberally as well. You know, these compounds are really God's gift to us as medicine, and also they appear to have significant effects on the endocannabinoid system. Even, you know, something like ginger, you know, everyone's jumping on the CBD bandwagon. There are over 100 double-blind placebo-controlled studies with ginger in the reduction of pain and inflammation. It's fantastic for that. Curcumin is good, and it gets a lot of the attention these days, but the real hero, I think, from a culinary aspect is ginger, and it's easy to prepare. You can juice fresh ginger. You can have ginger tea. You can add ginger to a lot of your dishes. There's ways to use ginger very liberally in the diet, and it has just tremendous benefits. And one of those benefits appears to be really helping that endocannabinoid system tone up and work better.
It's interesting. I can imagine some people that kind of watch or listen to this feeling a little bit deflated from their idea of thinking that they've got this kind of miracle answer in terms of CBD. And I think what's promising in terms of what you're saying is that it's not that there isn't something wonderful that's on offer. It's just that that's one small way to achieve something of which actually impacting the endocannabinoid system. There's lots of other ways that people probably are already doing and already have access to. And I guess part of what it makes me think in terms of a kind of more broad kind of question really is, you as someone that's been in this industry for a long time and seen a lot of kind of, I guess, fads come and go, and has seen the kind of the movement in different directions in terms of I guess particularly the functional medicine movement. When you see something like this kind of happen, where there's a particular kind of buzz around something, is that something that is kind of personally kind of concerning as a practitioner, that suddenly people are kind of being pulled in a direction? Or is it more of a kind of like, I've seen this before, just a kind of taking that kind of steady kind of path in terms of helping, I guess, you know, the industry to kind of to find a more measured perspective around it?
Boy, first of all, there's. I don't think there's ever been anything to this scale. There's been hyped products that have come and gone, but they have not been at this scale. This is unprecedented. I mean, like I said, the CBD market in the U.S. is probably over $1 billion now, so that's huge, and it's growing. So globally, it's there. We've never seen anything like it. We've seen similar things in the drug realm, where drugs were hyped and then, you know, didn't quite pan out, either some side effects or they weren't as effective as originally promised. but we've never seen anything to this degree in the supplement realm. And I think it's there's going to be more good that comes from it than the negative. The negative is that you know, some people may not get all the benefits that they're looking for, but hopefully that won't turn them off to natural approaches. It'll stimulate them to dig deeper. Good medicine is always about trying to identify the underlying cause and address it effectively. So right now we're focused on CBD to influence the endocannabinoid system, but you know, there might be some better approaches. There might be other plants that are more effective. We talked about PEA. I think PEA, I think it's, again, what people are looking for was with CBD. We know for many of these applications that PEA at a dose of 600 milligrams per day can produce fantastic results. So, you know, we can use hero ingredients, but they're always going to work better when they're in the context of a truly comprehensive approach. And maybe that's what we'll find with CBD too. We can always enhance the effectiveness of natural products, drugs, or any hero ingredient by making sure we improve our overall health. And, you know, it's the nature of the era that we're living in, you know, kind of looking for that cure-all, that magic bullet that's going to be a biochemical band-aid and take care of all of our issues. I think that's a bit of a trap. I think that health involves, you know, much more than taking a single ingredient. It involves, you know, having a very strong foundation. And this is important, I think, when you're trying to boost energy levels, because there are many facets to energy. And I'm sure all your other speakers talked on these. When I approach a person that wants to have higher energy levels, I first tell them that what influences the way that they feel and how much energy they have in their body is a combination of two things. One is their internal focus, what they're focusing on with their mind, with their conscious thoughts, because those influence our subconscious thoughts and actions. So we have to pay attention to what we're putting in our mind as much as we are paying attention to what we put in our body. So the way we can influence energy for a lot of people is influencing the amount of optimism and positivity in their life. And that sounds maybe something that's a little bit Pollyanna, but it works. There's a reason that you know, so many health experts and motivational speakers are preaching the power of the mind and the power of optimism and the importance of a positive mental attitude, because it does influence the way our cells work, and it does influence the amount of energy that we have in each cell and in our overall body. Next is physiology, and physiology doesn't just mean the nutrition that we have in our body, the hormonal aspects, various chemicals. It's also how we hold our body. And, you know, if you want more energy, you have to learn how to have an optimum physiology. And that means, you know, learning how to hold your body in proper posture, breathe in a relaxed but deep manner, be energetic, create energy in your body by moving on a regular basis. Exercise is important in influencing our physiology. And then, you know, we have specialty substances and compounds that we can use to enhance our energy through acting on our physiology. But again, I like to kind of break things down in simple terms. It really comes down to what you're feeding in here, what you're putting in here, and what you're feeling in here in terms of the degree of energy that we have in our life.
I didn't mention before we started recording, but my background's on psychology, so you're certainly preaching to the choir here, and it's great to hear you say that as we're kind of taking the kind of tour as we are. I'm mindful of time, but just a few more questions. I'm curious as to either in this area we've been talking about or more broadly, what are you excited about for the next 5-10 years? As I say, as someone who's got a lot of experience and seen a lot happen over the years in this field, what excites you about what you, either what you see that's starting to emerge or what you hope is going to start to emerge?
Well, what we've been talking about is very interesting, right? The endocannabinoid system, that's emerging. Another aspect of our health that's emerging is the importance of the microbiome. And, you know, my view on that is, it might be a little bit of a heretic, but I think I predict that what the research is going to focus on is the importance of the terrain. We've almost had kind of reverse germ theory happening right now with the microbiome. So the germ theory was developed by Louis Pasteur. He thought he could tag a disease. Every disease would have a microbial origin. And a counterpart to Pasteur was Bernard. And Bernard said the pathogen is nothing, the terrain is everything. And Metchnikoff and others kind of proved that as well. But Pasteur and Bernard were engaged in very scientific debate their whole lives. On Pasteur's deathbed, he confessed. He said, Bernard is right. The pathogen is nothing, the terrain is everything. And right now we're focusing on certain bugs, but those probiotics, they're not that influential in changing the overall microbiome. And that's where I think looking at ways in which we can change the terrain will become the chief focus. And it's really exciting because what the research shows is that we can change the terrain dramatically through what we eat. And there's this mind-body connection. It goes both ways. But by the way that we think, our lifestyle, everything that influences health influences the microbiome, and we're going to be able to, I think, dial it in a little bit better than right now. We're just kind of throwing seeds. It's kind of like our microbiome is like a forest. It can either be a barren forest or it can be a rich rainforest. If the land is barren and the soil is fertile, you know, you might be able to throw seeds on it and grow some grass or whatever. But if you're trying to throw seeds on a well-developed forest, they're not going to spring forth any plant, new plants. So I think that's kind of what we're trying to do right now with some of our approaches to the microbiome, and that's going to change. It's going to be phenomenal. That's a really key area of focus. The other area, you know, is probably your area. When I was first starting in my medical career, the field of study was referred to as psychoneuroimmunology. Then they realized that the endocrine system was involved, and it became psychoneuroendoimmunology. And then they realized that the way our mind works and the way our detoxification system works is closely intertwined. So it became psychoneuroendotoxicology. And my point is that the word is going to keep getting longer and longer, trying to drive home the key fact that everything is connected. Every thought, every emotion, every experience that we have in life makes an imprint on not only our subconscious mind, but also our physiology. Identical twins, when they're born, they express about 99% of their genome identically. By the time they're 50, it's less than 3%. So what's changed? What's changed is the, you know, what they've been exposed to in their environment, what thoughts and emotions and experiences they've had in their diet. These are things that influence the way genes are expressed. So I think that this field of mind-body medicine is going to just continue to explode, and we're going to learn how important these relationships are between our thoughts and our body functions.
Fascinating. You've just given a bit of a kind of whistle-stop tour of some of the key pieces we've been exploring in the conference. That's nice to hear the validation from your perspective in terms of the importance of those pieces. Dr. Murray, I'm mindful of time, but for people that want to find out more about you and your work, what's the best way to do that? And I know that also you have some products you've created that affect the endocannabinoid system. Maybe you want to touch on that as well.
Yeah, so the best place to, if you're interested in following my work, is drmurray.com, drmurray.com. Yeah, so I want to make sure everybody gets that little booklet, because I gave a lot of information on the endocannabinoid system, but I've written a little booklet on it, and we'll make that available to people for free.
Fantastic. Dr. Murray, thank you so much. This has been really fascinating. And I hope for those that we popped the bubble, we reinflated a larger bubble, let's say, in terms of recognizing that there are many ways to work with this, and actually ways that are validated and actually have the potential to make lasting change. I think is very exciting.
Yeah, great.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed it. Good luck.